is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have with us tonight Dr. Gary Schwartz, and we're going to talk about his book, The Energy Healing Experiment and the Living Energy Universe. How are you, Dr. Schwartz?
Very good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for taking the time to come on my show.
My pleasure.
I hope you're ready. I have a lot of questions for you, some from your books and some where I'm going to pick your brain.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and how you got to where you are?
Wow. Well, I'm currently a professor in multiple departments at the University of Arizona, including psychology, medicine, and neurology. And I direct a laboratory for advances in consciousness and health. I'm also, by the way, corporate director of development of energy healing at Canyon Ranch Resort, because they're very interested in actually applying these kinds of techniques to real life services as well as doing research.
Wow. All right, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Are you an MD too?
No, I'm a PhD.
Okay. And your background is, your PhD is in psychology?
Yes, actually, I did my PhD at Harvard in 1971, and it was in the fields essentially of psychology and physiology, essentially mind-body medicine.
Okay.
But over the years, that expanded to include energy medicine and spiritual medicine.
So my first question to you is, what is consciousness to you? Because everybody has a different answer.
Wow. You want to know that I've done hundreds of radio and television interviews related to this work, and you know that no one has asked me that question. I'm just sharing with you that that's a great question, okay?
Thank you.
It's also one that I've thought about a great deal before I try to give an answer to that question. When I was at Harvard and then at Yale, I edited a series of books called Consciousness and Self-Regulation, Advances in Theory and Research, so it was something that was clearly on my mind. And of course, I now direct a laboratory that's called Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health. So you would think I would know what that word means, right?
No, because I've been doing a study of myself, and I've been getting every luminary I can come up with, and I asked that question, and you would be shocked at how many answers. And Mitt Goswami went, oh, my God, no wonder conventional science is not taking us seriously because we're not on the same page and don't know it. About a simple word, you know?
It's been a simple word. Well, when I use the word consciousness, it's typically used to be synonymous with the word awareness. So it includes things like sensation and perception and it's the minimal things that we associate with being able to discriminate things in the world. However, consciousness is much broader than that, because it also can imply being conscious of self. It can mean consciousness as in understanding. It can mean consciousness, of course, of emotion and feeling. It can mean consciousness as awareness of intuitive, if you would, nudges, and even what I sometimes call non-sensory awareness, which means that you're in a state where you're not aware of anything visual or auditory or kinesthetic, so you're not even aware of a quote thought, and yet you can have, if you would, an impression or a feeling of an intention, which can then provide you with something that you can then reframe in something that is normally sensory. So the word consciousness, depending upon how broad you make it, can apply at the quantum level, it can apply at the photon level, it can apply at the level of a star or the earth. In other words, you can talk about levels of consciousness or levels of awareness.
That's my next question. Do you think consciousness is in gradients?
is ingredient?
Ingredients. Two words. In and ingredients. In other words, what you said in levels.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the conclusion that I have been led to over the years in terms of both theory and science, data and science, and also supported by my own personal experience, is that the essence of what we mean by energy and information in physics and in the universe, in the cosmos, implies the existence of something that is, where consciousness is as fundamental as energy and information itself. And therefore, it's a fundamental property of the universe.
The reason I started asking that question, one of the reasons, is because, you know, when you try to talk to somebody about consciousness or spirituality or enlightenment, some people, it's like talking to a telephone pole, mm-hmm. and they think you're a know-it-all. And some people know exactly like what you're talking. You can't tell people about it. So in other words, I think that there's a gradient of, I don't like to say higher or lower because it's like being 5 or 50, but a step up where you have more information maybe.
Yes, I think that's true. And one of the things that's very fundamental about consciousness is that the only consciousness we actually ever really know is our own. And every other aspect of consciousness we have to infer. So, for example, I infer that you're conscious because partly by the nature of the sophistication of the questions you ask me and your responses to my what I say. And so I infer your consciousness from what I hear, okay? But note, it's an inference. I infer your consciousness like I infer that there's gravity. I let go of an object and it falls to the earth. By the way, every time I've done that, the object falls. It's a very replicable effect. But, you know, you can't see, taste, or touch gravity. Gravity is an inference. And it's the same thing with other people's consciousness. The only consciousness we know is ourselves. And I can't actually prove to you that I'm conscious. All I can do is give you various examples of my behavior that would lead you to attempt to infer that I'm conscious, and if you would give me the benefit of the doubt. And I'll never forget that realization and that humility taught me something very deep a number of years ago, because I realized that I could ultimately never prove, for example, that consciousness survived physical death, because I've been doing research with mediums and I've published 2 books in the area. And the reason was, if I can't actually prove to you I'm conscious when I'm alive, I'm not going to prove to you that I'm conscious after I died.
Very good point. Okay, my next question is, I want to ask you, is it a field or a wave, or do you think that it's both? I don't know if you get into that area or not, do you?
The answer is I certainly think about it. I mean, I started out as an electrical engineer, and so I have a background in physics, and physics for me is a hobby. Matter of fact, you mentioned Goswami, I think you did, in the beginning of our conversation. And I was just in speaking at a conference on energy psychology in Toronto a week ago and giving a keynote address. And also, Goswami was giving a keynote address at that same meeting. Anyway, for me, consciousness is neither a field nor a wave, although it can be expressed in field and wave characteristics. But to me, consciousness is, in some respects, even if you push me on this, it's even more primary than the idea of a field and a wave.
I agree with you. There's some thing that the field and the wave lie upon.
Yes.
To me, that's consciousness. What is that thing? Do you have any idea? Have you thought about it?
The answer is that I have. But if you would really push me and say, but what is, quote, consciousness, in its core, and I'm not sure that there's anything more fundamental than consciousness, although, as I said,
right.
there are levels of consciousness and degrees of consciousness and constant emergence of consciousness. One of my, I guess my hobbies, you could say, was a color perception and also art. And I'll never forget the visit with a painter called George Surratt, who was a pointillist painter, and he only worked in 11 colors. He had 11 dots. He painted in dots.
That's interesting.
And so, for example, he never painted in purple. What he did was he painted in red, and he painted in blue. And he would, if you put the red and the blue dots near each other, so they were, a hat had both red dots and blue dots, what you would see is purple.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that purple was an emergent, if you would, or grew out of the presence of red and blue. And the whole notion that each time you put two or more things together that you are conscious of, that a new consciousness can arise, and that new consciousness can be qualitatively different than each of the components by themselves. You know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that operates at every level in the universe is very, very striking. Also, one of the things that we discover is that our sensory apparatus is very sophisticated in serving as a tool to, of course, enhance our consciousness. And so now what we've done is we've developed technology which goes beyond our normal everyday experience of the three-dimensional reality. So if, for example, anyone's in the audience listening has seen the latest 3D movies, the three-dimensionality that's portrayed in the screen is actually deeper than we normally experience in daily life. And there have been new recording techniques and playback techniques for quadraphonic sound where you literally experience more spatial separation and depth to sound than you could actually hear with your normal ears. So even our sensory apparatus has capabilities for awareness that we ourselves would not normally know that we have. And I always stand in awe of the brilliance and beauty of the levels of consciousness that we can have.
Yeah. It interests me, and I won't get into this because I don't know much about it, but it interests me that he uses 11 colors.
Mm-hmm.
And the end theory, you know, the unified string theory says there's 11 parallel universes. David Hawkins says
right.
There's 11 levels of conscious awareness. I'm always interested in that number 11 when it
but
comes to
that. Why is that, by the way? Then I'll share with you a quick story.
Okay.
Why the number 11?
Well,
is that
I
a
don't
number,
know.
Is that a band? Number that's followed you around in your life?
Well, you know, I told you that I was a channel.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a book, and the book came out of the blue because I was not a seeker. It just came in the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, I wrote that there were 11 parallel universes, and I described them, but I don't know why I picked 11.
I'm going to have to read that book.
I'll send you one.
Please.
I don't know why I did it.
Okay, well, listen.
Go ahead and tell me your story.
Okay, well, I wrote a book called The G.O.D. Experiment, How Science is Discovering God and Everything, Including Us. And the word G.O.D. stands for Guiding, Organizing, Designing Process. And in that book, I had originally planned, as part of the main body of the book, as part of the evidence that led me to the idea that from a scientific point of view, that there was some sort of a guiding, organizing, designing consciousness fundamental in the universe that was both universal and infinite, was the emergence of extraordinary synchronicity that I experienced in my life and I've since witnessed in many other people.
Me too.
And before I tell you what that was very briefly, my writing partner and my editor felt that even though it was a true story, I mean, it was all factual, it was so extraordinary that many people wouldn't be able to handle it. It would sort of go beyond people's boggle factor, and they wanted me to exclude it from the book. And I said, I couldn't do that with integrity. But what I would be willing to do, and I did, was I buried it in Appendix C of the book. And it was called Synchronicity in New York City. I'm now finishing a book on synchronicity, and it's now chapter two, because it's really the introductory to this long journey. Now, the reason why I'm telling you this is that my synchronicity journey, which began when I was a professor of Yale, began with the number 11.
Really?
Really. And it was such a bizarre and wondrous story that that took me from a statistical anomaly to the heart of mystical Judaism, the Kabbalah, which I had never heard of, and then to extraordinary events that followed once I began to, sort of like follow the breadcrumbs of where I was being led, where one piece of information led to another piece of information.
I know, exactly. I haven't had that in my life, too.
Well, I know I'm speaking to a fellow compatriot here. So it's precious that I just spontaneously brought up George Seurat and the 11 colors because you've been asking me questions about consciousness and its primacy and its brilliance and complexity and so on. And then here we are reaching this very unique number.
It always happens. It always happens. I love it. It's all I think about is consciousness.
Ah.
Okay. I wish we had more. You're going to have to come back so
okay.
we can talk about this again.
You got it.
Do you think we have free will? And the reason, let me preface that.
Sure.
Everybody thinks that you have free will. But I believe if we had complete free will, that if you said, either meet me at Starbucks at 3 o'clock, I'd be there at 3 o'clock, not a minute before, not a minute after. I wouldn't get lost. I wouldn't forget. I wouldn't have a flat tire,
Right. It's very interesting. Many people, people have extreme positions about this. They either believe completely in free will and they can have anything that they want if they put their mind to it.
Yeah.
And then there are other people who believe that everything is completely determined and that there is no free will whatsoever. I fall sort of in the middle, and that is, my sense is that we have, quote, relative free will.
Mm-hmm.
It's free will within a whole bunch of constraints, and that things that we think are, that we even have, quote, freedom about, we're not aware of the invisible processes that are actually guiding us.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I have choices, for example, to look at my computer or not, and remember that I have a radio show scheduled for this evening with you, mm-hmm. It's a conversation. And then I have also the freedom to be responsible and to act on that information or not. So in that sense, I have some degree of choice. And in this context, I do. At the same time, what's amusing is that that I was led to look at my computer this morning because my primary computer actually crashed on Friday. And I hadn't checked what I was doing for the weekend. And I took it to the computer hospital, and learned on Saturday that it would need a new hard drive and so on. And, I always keep backup information, but I decided that I was going to, because my primary computer was not available, that I wasn't going to go on computer this weekend. I was literally not going to do an email, that I was going to treat this as a time to get organized and to reflect and so on. And for some reason, I intuitively turned on the computer. Even though I vowed that I wouldn't. And there was my laptop computer, and there was a reminder that today's radio show.
Well,
and then, by the way, an hour later, you called. Okay?
Whoa, I don't know what happened there.
No, I was wondering whether it was...
My cell phone just turned on. I had it turned off. And it just turned on all by itself.
So,
because I had it off so it wouldn't get disturbed.
Right. But I mean, if we really carefully look at our lives, thoughts, quote, pop into our heads and we can, quote, get urges. And we can choose to listen to those urges or not, but we're not creating them.
Yes.
So it's not like everything is completely destined, but there is... When you look at the totality of the data, again, if you're asking me my opinion, I'm sharing it with you. It is my sense that there is a macro plan, a macro direction, that there are many things that are, quote, beyond our control and beyond our even ability to imagine. And yet at the same time, within this within this master organizing structure, we can make choices.
So what do you think is the source of the original intention?
Oh, boy. Why don't you ask a simple question? No.
Because then it'd be like every other interview.
The conclusion that I have come to is that there is, and by the way, obviously this is not unique to me, it's been people have spontaneously come to this conclusion throughout recorded history. They have different names for it. But there is an essence, there is a source, there's a unity of infinite complexity and capacity for diversity that is a, you know, I think of it as an infinite intelligence, which, by the way, has the capacity, among other things, for infinite love. It's interesting, if I remember correctly, your show is actually called The Infinite Consciousness.
Yes.
In fact, at the end of the last chapter of the God Experiments book was called Infinite Love and Ultimate Gift from God.
Now, and the name of my book is Agape, by the way.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, then, of course, you appreciate, you know, this. And what I find quite remarkable is that there, if you could imagine something that is infinitely intelligent and infinitely complex and even infinitely wise and can be, can have infinite awareness, can be aware literally of infinite levels of existence all at the same time, which of course completely boggles our mind. And then you realize that each of us is a little spark or a little expression of this unified consciousness field, this intelligence. And even though we're just a tiny little speck within the vastness of what appears to be the physical universe and the energetic universe, our minds are, quote, big enough to be able to go from the infinitely small to beyond the infinitely all. In other words, we have the capacity to envision all of this and to learn slowly but surely various components of it. And so although in some respects we're really tiny, our essence, and you can teach this to children, is that with their minds there are no limits to size. There's no limits to scale. It's that potential is within all of us to connect with all of this and to serve it.
Okay, I'm going to combine two questions in this one. I'm afraid I'll forget. The first one is, what is mind? And the second one is, how do you think that's conveyed? Do you think it's, I like to use the word signaling, to be some kind of resonance with some kind of voltage or signals, kind of like the Morse code, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of goes like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da somehow, with some voltage behind it. You know, and maybe our brain interprets the length of the signal, the space in between, and how much voltage is behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just something I think about.
You have a very interesting mind yourself. You ponder all these questions.
That's been a lot of words to describe my mind.
Yeah.
I'm glad you used that one.
When I think of mind with a capital M, and I think of what it means, for example, in one's mind. And by the way, I think if I remember correctly, in the God Experiments book, for convenience, I use 11 levels of existence to illustrate this point.
Interesting.
Yes.
I love it.
Where I imagine, for example, a person to hold a photon in their hand, for example, which is one level, which would be a, quote, massless particle, and to imagine what it looked like and how it was functioning and so on. And then to imagine holding an atom in the hand, like hydrogen or oxygen, then imagine holding a large molecule, and then imagine holding a cell, and then imagine eventually holding a person in their hand, in each case describing, and then holding the whole Earth, and then holding a galaxy, and then ultimately holding the universe in their hand. And then holding themselves, imagining that that in their hand they're holding themselves, holding the universe. You're now stepping outside yourself and stepping outside the universe and looking down at all of this. And what we mean by mind, of course, is the capacity to be able to envision. I remember Einstein said that imagination was more important than knowledge. And this is not an imagination as in so much called fantasy, but it's imagination as in envisioning, the capacity to be able to, for one's mind, which is not limited ultimately by scale. So whatever this quote mind is, it has this capacity for, if you would, you know, for it to both envision and to be able to manifest almost any possible form, for almost any possible purpose. Now, when we say, okay, what is this mind then tuning into, and what is this mind processing? I too use the metaphor of signals and transmitters. In fact, in the Energy Healing Experiments book, I talk about how each cell is like a little cell phone, because it's both receiving information and is also transmitting information. And it's doing this electromagnetically as well as using other forms of fields as well. And the body is like a network. A coordinated network of all these simultaneous signals being processed and received. And one of the great mysteries and miracles of the body is how does, 100 trillion cells, each of which is to some extent functioning independently, but obviously functioning within units of tissues and then organs and so on, how is this ever coordinated into a unified whole? How does all this transmission have this unified...
I think you figured that out.
What?
I think you figured that out when you were talking about the EKG and the EEG, but I have another question I want to ask you before we go there.
Go right ahead.
Because you brought it up.
Sure.
Talking about transmitting and receiving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bill Tiller says he's discovered magnetic monopoles.
Yes.
Do you think that magnetic monopole could be responsible for why we send and receive?
I think it's part of the mechanism. And I think it's a very interesting mechanism. But I'm partly humble, partly confused, partly, having learned the lesson of the more you learn, the more you don't know.
Yeah, I say that same thing.
Yeah, I tend to be cautious about, if you would, putting all my eggs in one monopole or one photon, or putting a complete explanation in any single idea. I'd rather entertain them, celebrate them, and then let the universe teach us what different roles are.
All right, I have one more question, and then I promise we're going to get into your studies.
Okay.
And I hope you don't mind.
Listen, you don't have to get into any of the studies if you want. You know your listenership, and you have the questions, and I am in your service.
Thank you. I want to know, do you hear a high-pitched sound in your head? A really high-pitched frequency?
The answer is yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. We both have one of the same heroes, by the way, Irvin Laszlo. And
really?
I hear that sound, yeah. I hear that sound. And I've never had anybody to know, to talk about it first. So I've been asking everybody I talk to. And everybody that's, what's the word, spiritually evolved or enlightened or awake, whatever you want to call it. Everybody that I've interviewed, like, that's that way, has that sound.
That I've never heard before. That's very, very interesting.
And what I think it is, if you've ever been out in the woods where it's so silent that it's screaming.
Yes.
It's the sound of silence. You know?
Yes, but what... But what do we mean by silence?
It's a frequency in hertz, you know, and I think it's the sound that the original intention was placed on, because imagine a void universe that's silent is going to have that sound. Anyway, Irvin knew exactly what I was talking about, and he said, oh, Eva, it's the sound of B-flat. It's also the sound that comes from the black holes.
What?
So I wanted, did you know anything about it? Have you thought about it?
Well, since you're open to synchronicities, I'm currently finishing reading a novel called The Eight. And it's a very complex, sophisticated, you know, semi-fictional, semi-historic work. And one of the things they talk about is the relationship between harmonics and the music of the spheres and frequencies and the fundamental order of the universe and so on. And if I remember correctly, Laszlo began as a musician. And by the way, I was a professional musician, so I'm very, you know, no pun intended, tuned into music. It's really, you know, fundamental to my essence. And the notion that the highest possible frequency that we can imagine, because I suspect that what you and probably I and others are, quote, hearing is a harmonic of the higher frequency, even though it's a high-pitched sound in our heads, the actual frequency is much higher. In fact, I will share something on the show that I haven't reported publicly before. I only discovered it last month, it's consistent with this notion of a super high frequency. We've been doing some exploratory research, seeing whether or not we can detect the presence of what I call helpers, which that's an acronym for higher energies, loving presences, empowering resources, which is a friendly sort of semi-physical, semi-spiritual term for higher beings. All the way up to the source itself. And we're trying to see that if particular channels are in communication with these beings, and these beings are then invited to participate in laboratory research where we're measuring what are called biophotons, using a super sensitive, super cooled, what's called CCD camera system, whether we can detect their presence, particularly in interaction with living systems. Now, one of the things that this camera does is it's recording in pitch black, and it's looking primarily in the spectrum of light that we see with our eyes. But every now and again, it will pick up a gamma ray, a cosmic ray, which, of course, is a super high frequency, high energy photon. And this is coming from deep space, and it's typically treated as, quote, noise. You know, because you're not interested in measuring it. It just pops in whenever it does, and it interferes with what you're looking for. So what we normally do is there are ways to remove those artifacts, those cosmic rays, so you can get a cleaner image to then do your statistical analyses on. And what I did was I used this NIH, National Institutes of Health, image processing software called ImageJ, which, by the way, is free. You can download it from the web from NIH. And use this procedure to essentially separate the images into normal light and the cosmic rays. And then what I did was I spectral analyzed, using what's called a fast Fourier analysis, I spectral analyzed the normal pictures and the cosmic rays. And to my absolute amazement, in three experiments that we've done thus far, the largest effects of apparent higher spiritual measurement effects were actually in the structure of the cosmic rays. It was actually in changes in the organization of the highest frequency light that revealed their presence most dramatically. And that was a complete surprise to me.
So, do you think that that may be what the orbs are, you know, that Klaus Heinemann and Michal Ledwith have been photographing? Possibly?
I think I have not, I've given zero thought to the question of how this might relate to the orb phenomena. That's a very controversial area, but those are typically thought of as being, quote, in the visible light spectrum. Whether they relate to, to structural patterns of cosmic rays, which then might cause reflections that would be seen as an orb, is, by the way, a very creative suggestion on your part. I don't know.
So when you were doing this, were you just photographing the room in general, or are you photographing something?
Well,
and saw this come in with it.
Okay, well, first of all, it's done in complete dark in a chamber, and the chamber, which is a box, about 2 foot by 3 foot, I guess, approximate dimensions. This box is then itself in a dark room. So it's a dark box within a dark room. And in one experiment, it was merely what the lens was focused on was a black and white checkered stage that we would actually later put plants on, because plants, all living systems, quote, glow in the dark. They
emit
what are called biophotons. And partly for intuitive reasons, I wanted to see what the black and white checker would look like. Of course, in pitch black, you won't see anything. But to the extent that there's any light that's appearing, what should happen is the white portions of the checkerboard should reflect the light back to the lens, and the black portions should absorb the light. So what will happen is, and what we did was the camera took a picture for 30 minutes. It was a 30-minute exposure in the pitch black. So, and what happens is, when you do that, you actually see a very subtle black and white checkerboard. Very dim, but you literally can see it. Okay? And what we then did was spectral analyze that. Now, in the other two experiments, we actually put the leaves, and we put both leaves and flowers of a plant on this checkerboard. So then we're looking at spirit interacting with a living system, as opposed to merely just being in the background of the environment. And we got the effects in both cases.
All right. I have one question going back to what you were just telling me before that. I don't know what to call it. And then I want to talk about the leaves. Did you place any intention? Did you notice any difference if you place an intention for the light to appear or not?
Well, actually, the way the experiment was done, for example, in one experiment, my research assistant, who is a Jo-Ray practitioner, and Jo-Ray is a form of Japanese energy healing, what he did was, what we would do is we'd collect 30 minutes of background information, so we get a control, a pre-30-minute period. And then the second 30-minute period, what he did was he invited, through intention and prayer, the universal energy to enter the chamber and interact with the plants and whatever was present inside the chamber. So he actually had the intention of inviting the higher energy into the chamber. And then at the end of the 30 minutes, he then asked this to leave the chamber. And then we got another 30-minute post-intention period. So there were three 30-minute periods with an intention for spirit to be present in the middle.
And
that's how we observed the results.
Okay. So it was different when you placed the intention.
That was the manipulation. The manipulation was to invite have the intention, you know, in this of a channel, for example, or a research assistant, for the higher energy to collaborate and interact in the environment. And the only reason I'm sharing this right now is because you brought up the high-frequency sound, and you brought up the fact that spiritual people may be resonating to higher frequencies.
Well, I'm so interested. Thank you for doing that.
You're very welcome.
I really am. So let's talk about the leaves, then.
Okay.
I heard this story, and I don't know how true it is, but I heard a story that Fritz Popp had taken a picture of a corn stalk, but really what he saw was the corn stalk. It was a small corn stalk, I heard, but really what he saw was a big corn stalk in light when he took it. So did you find that there, in there? Did you find the whole leaf even when you didn't have the whole leaf there?
We've never...
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. We have never tested the idea of, for example, putting a leaf in, measuring its biophoton emission, so you actually image the leaf, then cutting a piece of the leaf off, and then putting it back in the chamber, and seeing whether or not the outline of the whole leaf is still present, even though part of the leaf has been cut, for example. We've never done that. So the answer is I don't know.
Tell us, wait, let me just see how much time we have left. It's 10:42. We have to stop at 10:55. So I want you to talk about whichever experiment you want to talk about first.
Sure.
And talk as much as you can until we have to go.
Okay. Well, since we've been on the topic of leaves and plants, let me share with you your readers about this, because this is in the book. One of the things that healers claim, gifted healers claim, is that they can actually see auras. It's a very controversial claim. And they claim, for example, that they can see light over people's heads and have different colors. Some people will see it over the shoulders. Some people will see it over the whole body. Some people can actually see into the body. And I'm curious, by the way, do you see auras?
No, but I do want to say this really quick. Maybe you can give me some insight on it. I have a little boy who's 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
And one day we were standing out at my garden, and he looked at me and said, "Mom, did you know that plants have soul? I can see it shining outside the plant."
I love it. That's beautiful.
And then a few weeks later, which was about 2 or 3 months ago, he woke up in the middle of the night, and he was scared, and he got up and turned his light on, and I noticed that it was on the next morning when I got up, and he said, "Mommy, I was scared. There was cursive writing on my wall in the middle of the night, in light." And I said, "Well, what did it say?" He went, "I don't know, Mommy, I can't read cursive writing, but it was writing on my wall in light." Have you ever heard of that?
No, I have not heard of that. However, again, just very curious, is that I had the privilege, and with some of my colleagues, to spend the weekend with a gentleman from the South, whose name I can't share right now, who is... in the Air Force and was also an engineer who's developed a super, super sensitive infrared camera system, which makes it possible to see things at great distances and also very, very, very tiny amounts of light. And it does it in real time. It actually generates movies. And he brought this super sensitive camera to Tucson for us to explore how this might be applied to healing, and also how this might be employed in the measuring of energy fields in plants and people, and also possibly spirit. And one of the things that was extraordinarily dramatic was that all you had to do, for example, was take your finger and, for example, go near a plant or go near a person's skin or touch it, and not touch it, just be near it, and you would literally cause the object to glow near where your fingers were. In other words, you could literally see the impact of the presence of one energy source affecting another energy source and leaving, for example, fingerprints, if you would, on a plant or a person.
Amazing.
And of course, the implication is that if you were writing, you would be leaving an imprint of writing, and that it would be glowing. So I'm just sharing with you that it's in principle, it's possible that that on a wall or something like that, something could be written and it would be seen in the dark, because the dark makes it easier to be able to see the subtle light. But getting back to the experiments in the book, one of the things that we've done a whole series of studies using these super-sensitive biophoton, or super-sensitive, super-cooled low-light cameras to measure the properties of plants. And one of the primary reasons that we work with plants is that plants are relatively small. They're easy to work with, and they will sit still in the dark for long periods of time, meaning that so they can get very stable photographs of long exposures. And we found, for example, that healers can, with their intention, literally affect these leaves, causing them to glow more or glow less depending upon the healer's intention. So with this technology, what we were able to then do was I realized that you know, if a plant, for example, is on a black background or a dark background, the background's going to absorb the light. But if the plant was on a light background, particularly a white background, then the background would reflect the light and reflect the light back up into the lens. So we started looking at what would happen if we put plants on white pieces of paper as opposed to black pieces of paper. Remember, it's pitch black in this room. And nonetheless, what happens is when you use the white paper, you actually see the aura around the plants. But more amazing is that if one plant is in close proximity to another plant, you actually see their auras intermingling. And you actually see an energetic matrix or structure. It's like they energetically reach out and interact with each other and create a, quote, relationship. And it's very dramatic when you see it. And we've done this, I would say probably 30 or 40 different experiments now, documenting that there really is light that extends beyond the body, that against a background you can actually then see it as an aura. But more excitingly is that this is a living, just as Fritz Popp says, that these coherent patterns of light serve as communication. You can literally see how the energetic fields interact as the plants are in greater proximity with one another.
That's amazing.
It really is amazing.
And let me ask.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Consciousness permeates everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to put a rock or a stick under there, would you see the same thing?
Well, that's a really great question. Every object in the universe, every object in anything that has matter, is glowing, meaning it is generating energy and information and receiving energy and information. So the answer is yes. Depending upon the frequency of light that you would see, first of all, you would see it glowing. The second thing, which is actually a more interesting question, which I have not thought about before, is to what extent do even so-called, quote, inanimate objects develop an energetic relationship with other objects when they're in close proximity? So, for example, what happens if a plant is in close proximity to a rock? Will the rock and the plant now also share their energetic fields? We've never done that experiment, but my prediction is that the answer would be yes.
I want to know if you do it. That's interesting.
Well, we are going to do it, and I'm going to blame it on you. Your suggested experiment.
So would you expect the light to be greater from the living organism? And what makes it living?
Ah, well, that goes back to the living energy universe, which, of course, we haven't talked about. We're just scratching the surface in all these topics. But what makes something living that's why Irvin Laszlo is one of my heroes, because he first introduced me to system theory, is that when you take combined system theory with quantum physics, what you discover is that anything that has feedback, and feedback is when you have circulation of energy and information between two or more things, what this does, it actually creates a relationship which involves the storage of information and energy, and this therefore has a memory, and this memory grows or changes with time. And this is as far as I can tell, it's a universal principle, and it applies from subatomic particles all the way to superclusters of galaxies and everything in between. And therefore, and one of the properties of life is something that dynamically changes and evolves over time. And of course, the prediction is that anything that has feedback evolves. And therefore, everything is evolving alive and also, by extension, quote, eternal. But to explain all that would take a bit of time.
Would the plants also have and I don't know what to call this, so I'm going to call it the EEG and the EKG. Would they have, you know, where you did the experiments where they overlapped, would plants have that same kind of signaling going on?
The answer is that they should theoretically have electrochemical / physiological signaling. It wouldn't be called EEG, because EEG stands for electroencephalograph, so it's particularly referring to quote, neurons. And it wouldn't be an electrocardiogram, because by definition that's an EKG or an ECG, which refers specifically to the heart. But it would have possibly an electrocellulogram, if you would, because all cells generate electromagnetic signals. So in principle, yes, they would generate an orchestrated electromagnetic signal, and it would be interactive.
So they would have two signals?
They would have they would have many signals.
I mean, like the I don't know what to call this again, so I'm going to use the EKG, EEG name. You know, we have that EEG.
Well, we have many more than two. We have an EKG, we have an EEG, we have an EMG, which stands for an electromyogram. Every muscle generates an electromagnetic signal. So we have many different, if you would, organs that generate different signals. Now, I think what your question is, does each leaf generate its own signal? Does the trunk generate a different signal than the leaf? Does the roots generate a different signal from the trunks? And the answer is, in principle, yes.
Okay.
The qualification is so that all of them would actually be interacting with each other, which, by the way, is also what happens in an animal or a human being. Our EEGs, our EKGs, and our EMGs are all circulating in the body. So they're all ultimately. In fact, if you put one electrode on the top of the head and the other electrode on the bottom of your feet, you'll pick up EEGs riding on top of EKGs and EMGs, and they're all mixing together.
It's 10:53. I wish we had another. You're going to have to come back. I still have about 40 more questions. So why don't you take this couple minutes and tell people where to find you, where to find your books, how to contact you.
Yes, there's a website. It's www.drgaryschwartz, that's a drgaryschwartz.com. And that includes, you know, a biography, and it includes examples of different books that I've written and papers that I've written and other kinds of exemplary things. It'll also bring people to the laboratory website at the University of Arizona. I don't have very sophisticated websites because it's not a primary focus of my life, but it will certainly introduce people to the work and also enable them to contact me.
And your books?
The books are, the most recent is the Energy Healing Experiments. And previous to that was the God Experiments. And I did a book called The Truth About Medium, which was a follow-up to a book called The Afterlife Experiments. And my first book was The Living Energy Universe. I'm talking about books that were published for the general public.
Well, all I can say is thank you. I mean, this has been great for me, and I loved your books, and I just hope you'll come back because I have a million more questions.
Well, thank you. I wish it was reversed. I would have preferred me asking these questions of you and hearing all the wisdom that you have, because you're overflowing with it.
But, well, you've got my phone number, so you can always call me.
You've got it. Thank you, and bless you.
Thank you so much. Take care. And agape to you. Good night.
Good night.